طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we explore the crisis of Palestinian leadership and the role that civil society plays in the resistance to the Israeli occupation, featuring Ahmed Abu Ardama, Palestinian writer and activist and the key architect of the March of Return in Gaza, and Marwa Fatafta, policy manager at Access Now. In this session, we explore issues surrounding Palestinian civil society, and in particular, human rights defenders and democracy activists, and the challenges and threats they face, including direct attacks by Israel, targeting by Palestinian authorities, and apathy and indifference from the international community in the face of these attacks. We begin with Laura Friedman framing the conversation.
Terrific. So just as a quick scene setter, in this session, we're going to explore issues surrounding Palestinian civil society, and in particular, human rights defenders and democracy activists, and the challenges and threats they face, including direct attacks by Israel, targeting by Palestinian authorities, and apathy and indifference from the international community. A lot has been going on in this sphere over the past year, including widespread Palestinian grassroots mobilization last May, linked both to events in Jerusalem and Israel's subsequent military operation in Gaza, including the killing of Palestinian civil society activist Nizar Banat at the hands of Palestinian security forces and the popular activism that followed that, including Israel's designation of six Palestinian major human rights and civil society NGOs as terrorist organizations, which was preceded by the targeting of NGO staff with terror charges, and of course, including the Great March of Return in Gaza. So Khaled, why don't you start us off with our questions?
Great. So Ahmed, I want to start with you as an activist, as a leader in civil society based in the Gaza Strip. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation in Gaza with respect to Palestinian civil society, organizing and activism in support of human rights, civil rights, democracy, and so forth? How does civil society seen in Gaza, for example, differ from that in the West Bank in terms of, just given the differences in governing authorities and in governance in general, and the conditions are different as well. How are the objectives similar, and in what ways are they different? And also, if you could talk a bit about the extent to which there is collaboration in terms of civil society between Gaza and the West Bank.
Actually, the situation in Gaza, I can talk about it as there is a kind of inactivity in general relating to the civil society. I think there are many reasons behind this. One of the reasons because of the human suffering among the youth in general and the high rates of poverty and unemployment. This makes the less interested in the engagement with the civil society and with the political and social work in general. And they say we are not able to secure our basic necessities. So we don't find time to engage with the society and with the activities. This is one of the reasons. I think there is another reason relating to the cancellation of the elections were supposed to hold on the last year. After the decision of the President Abbas of canceling the elections, the disappointment among the people. So the majority of the Palestinian people were looking at the elections at that time as the last hope that they can renew their reality, the legitimacy of their rulers. There is an opportunity for new leaders to come after the, you know, the current leaders in Palestine. They are without elections since 16 years, the last election. So many generations were growing without expressing themselves in to vote, without practicing their right to vote. So after the cancellation of the elections, I feel the appointment was increasing. And there is another reason that because of the place of Hamas in Gaza Strip, Hamas became more strong after the last events, including the confrontation on last May between Gaza and the Israeli occupation forces. At that escalation, the people looked at Hamas as hero. So when Hamas became stronger, this means that the civil society lost its power. So to be honest with you, I'm not satisfied on the power of civil society now in Gaza. When it comes to West Bank, I never visited West Bank, unfortunately, as maybe the majority of the of my generation in Gaza Strip and the younger generations. So I don't have a comparison between Gaza and West Bank. But when we saw the crime of the assassination of Nizar Banat, this gave us a message and gave us a sign how it's very dangerous to practice your in expressing your political idea, opinion, your political opinion. And I think my colleague can speak better about the situation in West Bank.
Thank you, Ahmed. And Marwa, that's a perfect segue. You know, I want to say that we're talking about the West Bank and Gaza Strip as if they are separate entities, when obviously all of this is Palestine. And people forget that under the Oslo Accords, Israel agreed to treat them as a single territorial area. That's the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. But de facto, Israeli policy now for more than a decade, almost two decades at least, has isolated them from one another to the extent that it is a very different examination to understand the realities on the ground in one place and the other. So can you basically answer the same question? What is the situation in the West Bank, and to the extent that you can talk about East Jerusalem as well, with respect to Palestinian civil society organizing and activism in support of human rights, civil rights, and democracy? And you know, maybe go a little bit more into why it is different than in the Gaza Strip.
Thanks a lot, Lara and Khaled, for organizing this webinar today, and I'm happy to be with you. Directly to your question, I think in terms of civil society space in the West Bank, we've reached a precarious tipping point. There are two significant events that happened yesterday, and you've mentioned in your introduction. One, the assassination of Nizar Banat, a Palestinian political dissident who was criticizing the performance of the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership on YouTube and on social media. And that signals the increasing intolerance of the Palestinian Authority for any form or shape of peaceful political dissent in the occupied territories, and specifically in the West Bank, where they have, of course, a certain level of control, right? And I believe it might be actually the first instance of straightforward incident of assassination. And you can imagine the chilling effect of that incident on many Palestinian journalists and activists who are in the West Bank and are unable to a certain degree express their views, especially in a context where Palestinians don't necessarily view their leadership favorably. I mean, the leadership's legitimacy has been expired, as Ahmed mentioned, for 16 years, for over a decade. And the other significant incident is Israel's designation of 6 most prominent human rights organizations in Palestine as terrorist organizations. Of course, that means that they are facing the imminent threat of detention, closure of their offices, confiscation of their devices, and pretty much being banned from doing this work. And the underwhelming response from the international community is equally dangerous and scary, because it signals to Israel that you can pretty much do anything, as in labeling prominent human rights organizations as terrorists. These kind of acts are done by the likes of Russia and China and, you know, the most authoritarian powers there are in this world. And yet that, you know, there was no response from the US or from Europe, from the EU to basically pressure Israel to lift the labeling and the designation, which means that at this rate, if we continue under these circumstances, I do have a genuine fear that the Palestinian human rights movement might be annihilated, where you literally don't have a space to exercise the work and have the space to document human rights violations committed by the Palestinian Authority and by the Israeli occupation forces, and be able to use international human rights mechanisms like the UN, the current probe happening right now at the International Court, the ICC, and so on and so forth. So it's an overall dark picture. And I don't think that we are going in any positive direction if, as long as the Israeli authorities are not held accountable for their attack on Palestinian civil society.
Ahmed, I wanted to come back to you and dig in a little more on sort of the objectives of civil society engagement. And you mentioned, both of you mentioned the issue of elections, and the lack of legitimacy of the current leadership. There was a lot of talk about elections this time last year, and civil society was deeply engaged in preparing for those elections, debating what the objectives were, how they should take place. And obviously they were canceled. I want you to dig into that a little bit. First of all, for why elections matter under occupation, right? As long as there's still the overarching occupation, why is it that elections are important to Palestinians? And for a society, a generation of civil society actors that have not had any taste of democracy yet, what they hope to achieve with elections now, and what you think the prospects are. And this is something that really crosses, because it's clear there will be no elections unless they can take place in all of the areas, right? West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, that's a red line politically. So what are the prospects of that moving forward, and what is civil society's role perhaps in making that happen?
Yes, thank you. The elections was important because it's an opportunity for many generations. They never vote. Because, you know, there is the leadership in general in Palestine, and not only in Gaza and West Bank, but also comes to the PLO representatives. They represent the Palestinian people across the world. So the National Council. So the people need to feel that their leaders represent them, and they are elected by them, then this can increase the responsibility of the leaders, and this will protect the leadership from the dictatorship and from the corruption. When the current leaders, when they are still in their places since 16 years from now, so this means there is no accountability. This means that there are new generations. They don't feel that those leaders represent them, and this is very dangerous. So Even if we are against Oslo Accords, that the Palestinian Authority based on the Oslo Accords, but the elections, we don't look to the elections only as one of the products of Oslo Accords, but it's the right of the generations. It's the right of the people. How can you, as a person in the leadership, how can you speak on behalf of me and I don't have the right to vote, to choose you, and I don't have the right to ask you, I don't have the right to bring you to the accountability. So the cancellation of the elections was very make many disappointment among the people, because this means that the leaders will not care more about the general opinion, the opinion of the Palestinian people, because their legitimacy came from the power and came from the relations with Israel, the security coordination, or the power, not came from the what the people want. So, and by the way, this is why the PA killed Nizar Banat. They killed Nizar Banat because he increased his voice against the dictatorship and against the corruption. They feel that it's unallowed for some activists or parties to break the silence and to make a general opinion, to make a pressure against the people who are in the circles of responsibility. So we should increase, not only because yes, the elections is our right, but because to engage the new generations, the young people who never engaged in any political work, to engage them in the cause of their people, in their cause, and to make them feel that this is our cause. For me, as example, now I'm 37 years old. In 2006, I was about 21, and I practiced my right to vote at that time. And it was the first and the last time until now. But so I can make comparison between my feeling at that time and the feeling of the generations today, the new generations, here we call them the generations of TikTok and Instagram, because sometimes we feel that this is the only window of them, the only space of them to express their selves. When I speak, when I make discussion with the young people and ask them about the political issues, and many times I feel disappointed. I feel they don't care about this, and this is very dangerous for us in the national level. At my time in 2006, when I was in the same time, I was able to feel how my generation at that time very active in the political work, and because they had the opportunity at that time to express their selves on the social and the political work.
Thank you, Ahmed. And for folks who have been following the series, we actually did in another session of the series focused specifically on refugees and the call for return. I highly recommend that. That was a really featuring Omar Al-Ghabari from Zohrot, Hani Al-Matun from UNRWA USA, and Francesca Albanese from Georgetown University. Terrific session. But so Ahmed, you gave me a perfect link to what I want to come to with Marwa, which is So, you know, on the heels of the Great March of Return, last May, we saw tension and clashes in Jerusalem, which I referenced earlier. This was over Israeli policies targeting East Jerusalem residents. And then there was a major Israeli military operation in the Gaza Strip. And then we saw related clashes in the quote unquote mixed cities inside Israel, which included heavy-handed Israeli security tactics against Palestinian citizens. And in the wake of that, we saw widespread punitive arrests of Palestinian citizens. So all of this appeared to mobilize and to reflect a powerful sense of shared purpose and shared future amongst Palestinians across geopolitical borders, right? This fragmentation between the areas that we talked about earlier, uniting Palestinians, West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza Strip, and inside the Green Line. So I want you to talk about that. Where do you see that going? You know, starting with the Great March of Return through the arc of where we are today. And also, can you talk about the role of technology in breaking through the barriers and in fixing or challenging the fragmentation that has been imposed on Palestinians over the years, including Palestinians in the diaspora, by the way?
Yeah, thanks, Lara. I mean, as a matter of fact, the events of last year are called the Intifada of Unity. Specifically for the point you mentioned, I live in the diaspora, even though I don't label myself as a Palestinian diaspora. I have family in the West Bank and I go there regularly. But there was a shared sense of unity. And we have been going through decades of political stagnation. Maybe stagnation actually is not the right word, deterioration, since the failure of the Oslo Accords and the two-state solution paradigm. These have not worked. The international community's promises to the Palestinian people have not materialized. It's 2022. We don't have a state, and there is no hope that we're going to have a state on some extremely fragmented, limited geography. Now, for the first time since the spark of the protest in Sheikh Jarrah, it was started by a number of families in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, who are facing the imminent threat of eviction from their homes. And by that, I mean, in the larger scheme of things, it means the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem and emptying it of its Palestinian indigenous population and substituting that with Israeli Jewish settlers. It's been an Israeli policy since time immemorial. That evolved, and a lot of Palestinians, including myself, have been watching. You know, I live in Germany. I have been watching what is, you know, the events on the ground on social media. And for the first time, there was a revived sense of hope and purpose and agency. I think agency is an extremely important element here, because for a long time, we felt that we've lost our agency over our own present and future. We have, as we said and already discussed, we have a Palestinian leadership who's been expired, extremely old, disconnected from the Palestinian people, their needs. And by the Palestinian people, I don't mean those of us who live in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, but also those who live in refugee camps and live, you know, there are 10 million Palestinians who are living in exile or in diaspora. And those are being completely dismissed. You know, they're not even on the books of the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership. We see, of course, also the PA or the Palestinian leadership adopting this, you know, using the words of Noor Arikat, this policy of acquiescence, you know, just giving up and maybe hoping that the international community will grace them one day and fulfill the promise of this state, right? And as I said, like for once, Palestinians were able to mobilize. There were no Palestinian factions being involved in street mobilization. And we felt that actually it's not all doom and gloom. It has not ended yet. There's still space for us to mobilize. There's still space for us to make change and difference. Now, to your second part of your question, you know, I have been studying digital activism and social justice movements and resistance movements in the MENA region for almost a decade. And one conclusion I can share is that online activism is great, has opened a lot of new doors. but it's not sustainable, and it cannot really fulfill the purpose of liberation or fulfill the purpose of social justice and political change on its own. So the question of, you know, where do we go from the events of Sheikh Jarrah and the Intifada of Unity, there needs to be sustained political organizing on the ground, coupled by political organizing online, because of course in this world, there's a lot of apathy, and of course with social media, it goes in cycles and waves. Right now, everybody's have their eyes on Ukraine, so it would be really hard. You know, let's say if the events of Sheikh Jarrah took place now, amid Russia's invasion of Ukraine, I don't think we would have received the same attention from the world to the plight of those families. So we can't really bet on online activism to deliver justice and freedom to the Palestinian people. And civil society, and I agree with Ahmed's conclusion that, you know, Palestinian civil society need to play a greater role in mobilizing Palestinians. Right now, it's been pretty much grassroots mobilization. And the big organizations, they do extremely important work on documentation, that kind of traditional, you know, human rights work. But they're also disconnected from the Palestinian populace to a certain degree. They fit in this Oslo paradigm, right? A lot of them still work on the hope of establishing a social contract of, you know, Palestinian citizenship. And going to the point on elections, I don't think you can actually build a democracy or maintain a democracy under military occupation. I mean, it's a disingenuous argument. I don't think it's politically viable. And let's not forget, when Palestinians did exercise last time their right to elect their president and the legislative council, the international community boycotted the results. And we all know what happened after that, you know, and then in terms of political fragmentation between Hamas and Fatah. And so, I'm moving in a lot of in different topics, but I just wanted to say that tomorrow we have local councils elections in the West Bank. So, you know, every now and then the PA kind of allows or permits, you know, permits these elections to take place in a way to kind of let some steam off and maybe to let Palestinians think or believe that they can exercise some political agency or can organize themselves. But the ceiling for that political participation in decision making on what governs Palestinian lives and futures is really extremely low. I mean, we're talking about municipality elections. What do municipalities do in the West Bank? They provide water, they can build roads if they have money, and electricity. And not, you know, so that's the level of political organizing or participation, if you may, in the West Bank. And we have reached a point where, if we put all these different factors together, there is a huge responsibility for Palestinians to continue their mobilization and continue what they started in May 2021. I don't have answers to where we're going at the moment. You know, we're facing all sorts of odds, and there is not one Palestinian movement that is able to take the achievements of last year forward. So it's a bit of a huge challenge, but at least the hope has been rekindled, and we might see more new movements springing up soon.
Thank you, and yeah, it's nice to it's a hopeful thought, and I think we're all held on to that moment of hope last year and are watching for that. I want to shift. We have time for two more relatively short rounds, so we've covered a lot of ground, and thank you both for that already. I want to narrow the focus to what we titled the session, and we gave it a provocative title on purpose, Where's the Palestinian Mandela? And this is the kind of thing that we, as people working in Israel-Palestine here in the United States, hear really often. And it's usually used by critics of the Palestinians in the context of arguments suggesting that the absence of peace in the territory between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River is not due to settlements or policies of Israel or anything else. It's due to the failure of Palestinians to produce a courageous leader who is 100% committed to nonviolence, just like they people now misremember inaccurately, Nelson Mandela and, say, Mahatma Gandhi, whose movements have now been reimagined when they actually were not entirely exclusively nonviolent. So can you, I want to start with you, Ahmed. When someone says to you, as someone, you as an activist and someone who was involved in the Great March of Return and all of that, when they say to you, where's the Palestinian Mandela? What do you respond to that question?
The simple and direct response that Israel killed many Mandelas in Palestine. Yes, I think there are many sides for this question. First, it's relating to the nature of the Israeli occupation and the Israeli colonization in Palestine. And there is a difference between the situation in Palestine and the situation in South Africa. Yes, Israel is a state of apartheid, but actually it's worse than apartheid. So it's the problem of Israel is not only that the racial discrimination based on the ethnicity or based on the religion. This is very very clear in the Israeli policies, but there are many other sides that the uprooting of the Palestinian people, Nakba, and the ethnically cleansing, the massacres, the horrible massacres. There was no refugees in South Africa, but here in Palestine, there are about 6 million Palestinian refugees. So Israel itself, it's not just a matter of that we as Palestinians, we need our civil rights to be equal with the Jewish citizens. This is a part of the problem, but not all the problem. There are many other. Israel want no Palestinians, zero Palestinians. The problem of Israel with the Palestinian existence itself. So this makes it more difficult than the situation in South Africa. But even we as Palestinians, we were inspired by the struggle in South Africa. And I think it's important here to mention that the establishment of the boycott movement, BDS, in 2005. We know that it's this idea is inspired by the struggle of South Africa. And the activists who established the BDS are Palestinians from Palestine. And we know there are many activities across the world for BDS, and BDS message is very clear. It's based on the international law, and it's completely used the peaceful ways. But despite this, a clear image of the and a clear activity of BDS, we saw how Israel tried to criminalize BDS across the world, and the Western governments, British government, and some states in the United States, they are working to criminalize the BDS. So the BDS is a Palestinian attempt to produce the Palestinian Mandela. The March of Return itself, the March of Return was an important opportunity for the Palestinians to shift to the a more clear struggle based on the human rights and based on the rights. And but Israel, and I think deliberately filled this Palestinian tent to the peaceful and to the struggle based on the rights, because Israel want to keep the image that the Palestinians, Hamas and some militias we fight against them in the same context of the war against the terrorism and like this. The nature of the struggle in Palestine is more difficult than the situation in South Africa. And Israel and its supporters across the world, they tried. And Israel itself, we know in many activities for the Palestinians, Israel suppressed them violently, because Israel want for the Palestinians to stay in the stigma it gave for them in the world.
Thank you. Mama, can you answer the same question? And can you also, as an add-on to that one, talk about, you know, again, with online activism, with civil society, Palestinian civil society today intertwined with international Israeli civil society, can you talk about the efforts to delegitimize Palestinian activism? You know, again, this Palestinian Mandela argument basically used to argue that where is the peaceful protest? And how you see that intertwining going forward between social movements, the non-Palestine focused ones and the Palestine focused social movements in the future?
Yeah, I mean, to your question, I don't subscribe to this mythology. I don't think Palestinians need a savior or a man, you know, one man to run the show. As a matter of fact, I mean, one of the most inspiring and exemplary moments of Palestinian civil society in terms of mobilization, like mass mobilization and political organizing, is the First Intifada. And back then, there was a clandestine leadership. There were no icons or Mandelas. Nobody knew who they were. Of course, now we know. But and communication was primitive, you know, either, you know, people were spraying messages on with the spray cans on the wall, or extremely secretive, you know, schoolgirls hiding political leaflets in their bread loaves. And it was at that time where the Israeli authorities were forced for the first time in their occupation history to sit down with the Palestinians to negotiate. And also this Mandela idea kind of dismisses the fact that Israel has one goal and one goal only, and that is to establish an ethno-nationalist Jewish state. And that stands in complete contradiction with the idea of coexistence, peace, and justice. So, of course, Israel has always used the line of, you know, that we are ready for peace, but Palestinians are not ready. We're waiting for this Mandela to sit down with us. That's just them trying to buy themselves time to accelerate the building of illegal settlements in the West Bank. I mean, if we look at the number of settlements in when the Oslo Accords were signed to this moment in time, we have over 500,000, I think 600,000 settlers living in the West Bank. So it's just a matter of using the peace process, the so-called peace process. The whole Oslo paradigm is also made to, you know, create a Palestinian authority that is a subcontractor to the occupation. Israel got rid of its responsibilities as an occupying power under international law, and that is now being paid by the US and by the EU, the so-called international community, by pumping funds to the PA for education and garbage collection and I don't know what, like basic services. So it's been the most convenient occupation of all times to the Israeli government, while of course maintaining their system of apartheid. I mean, we have not discussed this enough today. Many international and Palestinian human rights organizations have concluded through their meticulous legal analysis that Israel commits the crime of apartheid, the most serious crime under international law, in the League of Slavery, torture. torture and genocide. And most recently, actually this week on Monday, the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine also concluded in his report to the Human Rights Council that Israel commits the crime of apartheid in the occupied territories. So within this constellation, how do we expect or believe that the only obstacle to peace is the emergence of the Palestinian Messiah or Mandela or Gandhi? I don't believe this is not a genuine argument. And as I said, this is not the path forward. What we actually need on the Palestinian side is to build a movement from the ground up, because the current political leadership, as we already discussed, has not served its purpose. And we need to come up with a new framework. We need to come up with new national goals. And that's incumbent upon us, really, for us to come up with a new leadership or a new form of governance or a new form of liberation movement. That's what we need, a national project and a national movement that represents us and our needs. To your second part, to the second part of your question on, how can we use online spaces and connect with the outside world, with international organizations, with Israeli organizations that are also working on the same goals. As I said, the current digital ecosystem is not neutral. It's becoming increasingly authoritarian. Social media platforms are also not neutral, right? From using algorithms that create everything we see and access, they pretty much control when and how and where we can access information using algorithms. And of course, they also decide on the terms of services, what is permissible on their platforms and what is not. And to our disadvantage as Palestinians, many of those policies criminalize, so to speak, Palestinian narratives, speaking about resistance or sharing, talking about ethnic cleansing or the mass digital censorship and suppression we've seen done by platforms themselves last year. So it makes it, we're starting again from a disadvantaged point of view. This being said, there are still pockets of space where Palestinians can connect with the outside world. There's definitely a narrative breakthrough that happened last year. Many organizations, seeing the most powerful and prominent human rights organizations in this world, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, turn around to do a different kind of analysis of the situation where it's more accurate. We're not only talking about a military occupation, we're talking about an entrenched system of domination and apartheid. And that's definitely, we're moving the needle in the right direction. And hopefully changing the narratives is a start for hopefully changing policy action on behalf of the US by policymakers and lawmakers in the US and in the EU. That's, I think, the missing link at this point in time, where international organizations have had their say. Now we're still waiting to hear what those powerful governments around the world are going to comment on those developments.
Thanks, Marwa. And I'm glad that you brought up the issue, the subject of the First Intifada, because this is actually going to be our last question to you. So if you could be as brief as possible, because we're almost out of time. But I want to kind of pose another provocative question to you all. When I look back at the First Intifada, it's really quite striking. You mentioned how they were communicating using these very primitive modes of communication. Certainly nothing, nothing existed like what we have today of instant digital communication in real time. People were using fax machines and phones and word of mouth. But also, in terms of the role that civil society played, it really played a critical role in shaping and sustaining that uprising, because there was a moment, for example, when because schools were a hotbed of activity, Israel closed down the schools. And so civil society stepped in, and there were underground schools, and there were popular committees at the local level taking care of these sort of quasi-governmental functions. There was no Palestinian Authority back then, and yet civil society was able to keep things together and keep society from falling apart. So I fast forward to today, we often talk about or hear predictions that the PA could collapse, that the Palestinian Authority, or they're running out of funding, they lack legitimacy, there are all kinds of reasons that the PA could collapse. Given that, if something like that were to happen, what is the state of Palestinian civil society today? Is that something that Palestinian civil society is thinking about, planning for, that is the eventuality of Palestinian collapse? And if you could handle that very small question in under 2 minutes each.
I'll try my best. Yeah, I mean, so of course the PA wants us to believe that the moment it dissolves, it's going to turn into a complete chaos. And many of those who work for the PA, it's a source of income for many families. But I always say that Palestinians existed before the PA and are going to continue to exist after the PA. I don't think that there has been a collective brainstorming session where Palestinians are collectively answering this question, you know, the aftermath of the PA. But I do believe in the will and the creativity of the Palestinian people. And I would not be surprised to see another level of organizing, organic grassroots organization. We've seen that to a certain degree, actually, last year. As I said, it was not, many of the protests did not happen because Palestinian factions said to Palestinians, go out on the streets. So I'm not too worried about that future. I think that Palestinians would be able to organize. For the specific question on the civil society, role of civil society, they do belong, some of them do belong to the Oslo era, and they might find it difficult to function. I mean, those who have been chasing after foreign funding and conducting programs that are not necessarily connected to the Palestinian people might not be able to fit to do that job. But we might find new modes of networking and of organizing that we have not necessarily seen, and the traditional players might not be the most prominent actors, but that's, of course, me speculating.
And Ahmed, same question to you.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, please correct for me if I go away from the answer. I think one of the points of the power in the First Intifada, that the civil society didn't based on basically on the foreign finance, but it was like a kind of volunteer here. The idea of the volunteer here was very strong in the First Intifada, so this made it more stronger and also more revolutionary at that time, and more connected to the national struggle, Palestinian struggle. The problem today, in my opinion, that many NGOs depends on the European Union finance. This makes many restrictions, and sometimes you feel that the NGOs doesn't represent the real situation in Palestine, the real popular situation in Palestine. So we need to focus on how to find the national lobbies, the popular lobbies, based on the idea of the volunteer here in Palestine. This can make us stronger in the national role when some events happened, like the First Intifada. At that time, we can find that the situation will be stronger.
We have to end it there. You've been listening to Laura Friedman and Khalid Al-Gindi in conversation with journalist and activist Ahmed Abu Artema and Access Now's Marwa Fatafta, discussing the role of civil society in leading the resistance to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to TruthandJusticeRadio.org, all one word, TruthandJusticeRadio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.